Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Not Just Yesterday, the Roddy McDowell podcast. I hope you all had a wonderful holiday season, enjoyed the start of a new century, and are staying safe during this global pandemic of coronavirus. Today is a perfect listen if you're under quarantine, and will prove to be something a little familiar to you all as it covers a topic in Roddy's career, which has been spoken of often on Not Just Yesterday. As promised, this is the final episode you've all been waiting for, closing off the Planet of the Apes saga. You may notice that the body of the show sounds rather familiar to you. Don't worry, you're not having déjà vu. It all sounds familiar because you've heard it before, in the research sections for the previous episodes on the Planet of the Apes. Since I discussed the Apes films almost 2 years ago, and the research available to me for the TV series was also pretty extensively covered in those shows, leaving me with a smaller amount of research for the end of this series of podcasts, I thought it would be helpful to start the show off with a review of the films before moving on to the TV series. I have also added some new little elements to the reused portions of the previous Ape shows from 2018 to make them flow better and give them a new and improved feel. I hope you find the results of these changes to be enjoyable. And now, without further ado, let us begin with episode 18 of Not Just Yesterday.
Every night at 7, you walk in as fresh as clover, and I begin to sigh all over again. Every night at 7, you come by like me returning, and me, oh my, I start in yearning again. You seem to bring faraway spring near me. I'm always in full bloom when you're in the room, for every night at 7, every time the same thing happens, I fall once again in love, but only with you.
The story of Planet of the Apes was based on the novel Le Planète des Singes, written by French author Pierre Boulez, author of Bridge on the River Kwai, and was ultimately envisioned by producer Arthur P. Jacobs. Jacobs teamed up with Rod Serling to write scripts after purchasing the rights to the novel before it was eventually published in the early 1960s. Knowing the film needed a star to gather interest from studio heads, Jacobs contacted Charlton Heston to play the lead role in 1965. Heston agreed to do the film, but they had trouble getting the studios to take them seriously. There were multiple concerns that the audience would laugh at the ape makeups, so a test was ordered for a scene with primitive makeups to be filmed. The makeup test scene starred Chuck Heston, James Brolin as Cornelius, Edward G. Robinson as Dr. Zaius, and Linda Harrison, who would later play Nova in the film, as Zira. Ben Nye did the makeups for the screen test, which passed inspection with flying colors. Seeing that no one laughed at the makeups, Zanuck gave Jacobs the go-ahead, and the production went into full swing. The location chosen for the majority of the filming was Malibu State Park, aka the Fox Ranch, and filming officially began in the spring of 1967. Now the production needed someone with a firm knowledge of prosthetics to create lifelike makeups for the roles of the apes, and John Chambers was brought in to take over the makeup department.
Chambers was a former World War II medical technician who had begun his career working in a veterans hospital, designing prosthetic limbs and facial restorations for injured soldiers. In the early 1950s, he moved to California, believing his unique skills would prove a valuable asset to the newly emerging television industry. His skill with prosthetics soon put him at the top of his profession. Within a decade, he was developing creature makeups for shows like The Munsters, The Outer Limits, and Lost in Space. He even designed Mr. Spock's famous ears for the Star Trek television series. Chambers was innovative, clever, and quick, skills that would be put to the test when he began working on Planet of the Apes in January 1967. The task was formidable. Chambers and his team had to design appliances that could turn over 200 human beings into walking, talking apes, do it for under $1 million, and make it happen in less than 4 months. Surrounding himself with talented artists and promising newcomers, Chambers worked around the clock, and extras were hired just to sit in for numerous makeup tests. Next, design choices were made to differentiate various types of apes. Chimps, who were sympathetic to man in the story, were made to look a little more human in appearance. The gorillas represented the ape military and were given faces much fiercer than their real-life counterparts. And the aristocratic orangutans were given a more noble visage. What Chambers was creating for Planet of the Apes was not only ingenious, it was breaking new ground.
The actors actually were able to express emotion through those makeups. It's kind of tough. And John Chambers made it work.
The society from the novel was originally very high-tech and modern, fully advanced with everything from helicopters to weapons. But this high-tech society idea would far surpass the budget for the film. So, another idea had to be dreamed up. It was then decided that the ape society would be made a primitive one, and the production was able to continue in its preparations for filming. Mike Wilson was then brought in to do a rewrite on Rod Serling's faithful to the novel script, to change the society and bring in believable characters. William Krieber was then chosen as production designer and went to work on creating the primitive community for the apes' planet. Before filming began, however, Edward G. Robinson pulled out, citing health concerns and admitting that the primitive ape makeup for the screen test drove him crazy, and he couldn't foresee comfortably doing the full-scale production. To add insult to injury, after losing their original choice for Dr. Zaius, the studio, concerned with the ever-growing budget for the film, cut the production's shooting schedule from 55 days to 45. This affected everything within the film except for the makeups and the budget. With a final amount of $5.8 million agreed upon, the shooting finally went forward on May 21, 1967. The first shots actually filmed were the astronauts' trek across the wilderness. The scenes were filmed in a desolate location surrounding the Colorado River in Utah and Arizona. These sequences were filmed in order and at length by director of photography Leon Shamroy. During these many days of filming the opening sequence, the heat was often as high as 120 degrees, causing one of the actors to pass out from the extreme temperatures. The shooting went on for several days, as the director felt it set the mood and the tone of the film, causing the audience to feel a sense of being lost and having no idea where they are going. This builds up a feeling of claustrophobic foreboding, which remains a palpable emotion throughout the rest of the film. The remainder of filming took place at the Fox Ranch. The scene of the hunt was to be the most powerful and disturbing of all the sequences in the film. Zanuck really wanted it to grab the attention of the audience and really shock them. Director Franklin J. Schaffner, now behind the camera, shot the sequences in order.
Helping to create an eerie, otherworldly atmosphere was the experimental music score composed by Jerry Goldsmith. Goldsmith utilized unusual instruments like metal mixing bowls, a ram's horn, and a Brazilian cuca, which could recreate ape vocalizations.
At the end of the hunt, Taylor is taken captive and comes into contact with Dr. Zira, played by Kim Hunter. Zira is sympathetic to the humans and seems to be the most trustworthy of the apes in the hospital. She is engaged to Cornelius, who is an archaeologist in the ape civilization.
Arthur Jacobs personally offered me the part of Cornelius on a plane flight back from London. I accepted immediately, intrigued by the technical challenge of acting inside the elaborate ape makeup.
I remember Roddy McDowall saying that the trick for acting behind those makeups was to overact with your face, then it would bleed through the makeup.
If we didn't keep the appliances moving, they began to look like masks. I got very used to making them move all the time. We were doing all kinds of crazy little things with our face all the time to keep them moving. Roddy and I had to kiss, and we had no sense of feeling. We had to really work hard to make it look as if we were properly kissing each other without squishing the appliances.
Cornelius.
Enter the role of Dr. Zaius, which was taken over after the departure of Edward G. Robinson by veteran stage actor Maurice Evans. Dr. Zaius is an orangutan and a skeptical elder statesman in the community. He believes that man is a wasteful nuisance, and that it is a waste of time for chimpanzees in the hospital to study man at length. He feels man is best exterminated rather than studied. Taylor is determined to not only escape, but to prove Dr. Zaius is wrong, and to fight for the rights of man in the upside-down simian culture. This results in his escaping from his prison and running amok through the ape civilization on a number of occasions, which proved to contain many inconveniences and discomforts for the actor portraying him during the film.
Actors are supposed to be able to accept the circumstances, the premises of whatever project they're doing. But it was a very unusual acting challenge. Painful. So I could run apparently barefoot. They had rubber booties that were molded to be feet, and that protected me from thorns. We were doing some stuff where I'm running through the shrubbery and people are throwing things at me. And I said to Joe Cannot, who doubled me, would you mind just doing these last couple of run-throughs? He says, no. I said, what do you mean? He said, you've been working all afternoon in poison ivy. So I was. He says, you'll notice it tomorrow, and I did.
Behind the scenes during shooting, an interesting phenomenon took place, which must be mentioned here as it is an irony that coincides with the main lessons being taught by the film. During the lunch times, the different types of ape classes, aka the gorillas, chimpanzees, and orangutans, would all unknowingly segregate themselves from one another. None of the actors were aware of their doing this, however, it is very interesting to see, considering how segregation and prejudice is a very strong theme in the film, and is one that is being fought against by the protagonists of the story.
There was kind of a self-segregation. The gorillas would all eat at one table, the chimpanzees would eat at another, and the orangutans would eat at another. I have no explanation for that whatsoever, but it was true.
The actors were never conscious of it. They just drifted to their companions, to the same groupings as in the film. Fascinating.
Ironically, the issues of class separation and prejudice are one of the film's main themes. The ape society is given a distinct class structure. The orangutans are the politicians. The chimpanzees are the scientists and intellectuals. The gorillas are the laborers and the military enforcers. It was an allegorical device used by the filmmakers to make some pointed observations about human society.
Without ever saying it, we were doing a political film. We never even said it very loudly among ourselves, because at that time we were in Vietnam. And a political picture was the last kind of film that a studio wanted. The country was having very serious problems.
The film's strong themes on fighting racism, fearing people or creatures who are vastly different from us, and trying to destroy truth in the hopes of keeping one's political motives at the forefront of society's vision, were consistent throughout the entire series of films, and is broached most heavily during the trial sequence, as well as into the end of the film. During the trial sequence, Taylor's humanity and his recognition of language, ability to speak, and his high level of intelligence is constantly attacked by the orangutans, who feel that Taylor is a threat to their society, while Cornelius and Zira fight hard to prove to the politicians that he poses no threat whatsoever. Their consistent battling throughout the hearing, eventually proving that there was a human society on the planet before the apes took over, and their completely taking sympathetic allegiance to Taylor causes problems for the two scientists, who are eventually accused of heresy and made to be outcasts in their society. The end of the film, where Taylor discovers a decaying Statue of Liberty on the beach, was meant to simply shock the audience. It was never meant to really send a message, though that is how it eventually ended up. Shooting completed August 10th, 1967, on time and on budget.
Planet of the Apes had its world premiere on February 8th, 1968. It was a box office smash, grossing over $26 million and reaching audiences of all ages.
They build the cities, make the laws, the gods.
Adults responded to its intelligent script and first-rate performances.
Man has no understanding.
Children thrilled to the film's adventure and fantasy elements.
20th Century Fox transforms the motion picture screen into Planet of the Apes.
The film also found favor with critics, who praised its uniqueness, timely political commentary, and entertainment value.
Planet of the Apes, beyond your wildest dreams.
In 1989, while being interviewed by Hello Magazine, Roddy had this to say about the Planet of the Apes saga and its great box office success. Cinema is so unpredictable. You never know what the public is going to like. We all thought that Planet of the Apes would be successful, but the response it got was extraordinary. Nevertheless, there were movies of which I expected a better response, and the public hasn't gone and seen them.
In truth, the movie made a resounding smash hit with its audiences, and it unleashed a massive phenomenon that no one affiliated with the productions before or after the first film were prepared for. It created such a buzz that the studio practically demanded a sequel, and all of the stars from the original production were requested to return and reprise their roles. But some changes had to be made. Charlton Heston was also asked to return, but he was apprehensive of being brought back for a second film. Not being a fan of sequels or feeling very unsure about whether the next film would be better or worse than the first, Heston agreed to return with a proviso that his character be killed off in the second film. The producers had no problem with this request, and Taylor's death was sealed into the script and executed with great panache at the end of the film. The other problem with the production lay in Roddy's lap. When called to return for the Ape sequel, McDowell was in Scotland directing his first movie, The Ballad of Tam Lin, starring Ava Gardner and Ian McShane, who would later credit Roddy with making him a star, and was unavailable to return for the sequel. He was therefore temporarily replaced for the next film, and was able to carry on with achieving his directorial dreams.
When Roddy McDowall was asked in an interview why he was not in Beneath the Planet of the Apes, he was quoted to have said, "I was going to do it, as Kim Hunter and Charlton Heston did. Arthur Jacobs called me back, but I was involved in preparing the film I was going to direct. It would have taken 6 days or something, and I'd like to have done it, but it wasn't possible. I didn't see Beneath, although I want to see it." Roddy had been temporarily replaced by British actor David Watson as Cornelius in the second film in order to continue directing The Ballad of Tam Lin, which wouldn't be released in the United States until September of 1972 due to many difficulties encountered by the production. May the 26th, 1970 unveiled the second Apes film, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, much to the pleasure of audiences worldwide. Critically, it wasn't a smash hit, receiving mixed reviews, but it exceeded expectation at the box office, making a total of $14 million, returning three times the cost spent to create the film back to the studio. As a result, studio executive Arthur P. Jacobs, seeing dollar signs, informed writer Paul Dane that a sequel must be made. However, there was a fair bit of difficulty involved in finding a fresh and exciting idea for an interesting continuation to the story. After all, how do you recreate a world you've just blown up? Some creative thinking needed to be done, and quickly, to keep the storyline fresh and consistent. Dane got busy with thinking something up, and shortly devised an idea from the first film. He conceived the thought of rescuing and repairing Taylor's drowned spaceship in order for the apes to use it as an escape from the War of the Mutants, which would shortly destroy the planet, and thus, the third story was born. Filming on Escape began on November 30th, 1970. Having completed The Ballad of Tamlin, Roddy was now able to return and reprise his role of Cornelius, joined once again by Kim Hunter, reprising her role as Zira. They were also accompanied by Sal Mineo, who portrayed Dr. Milo. Having three apes as the main focus of the story was brought about as a budgetary precaution. It also made the story more convenient. It did not, however, make conditions more convenient for the actors involved with the production. Sal Mineo had an absolutely miserable time during the production. The makeup was excruciatingly claustrophobic for him, and he would really suffer from the long hours of wearing it on a set that was already hot from studio lighting. According to IMDb's trivia section, Sal Mineo had hopes that appearing in Escape would present him with a career comeback after seeing the resurgence of major stardom it had created for his friend Roddy McDowall. However, Mineo would shortly come to regret his decision to appear in the film. Originally, the role of Dr. Milo was intended to be slightly longer, requiring more filming time for Sal, but his extreme discomfort from the makeup and the effect they had on his mental and emotional state, as well as Sal's consistent complaining on set, caused this to be changed after a few weeks of production. In Sal Mineo, a biography by Michael Greg Michaud, Roddy is quoted talking about Sal's troubles with the ape makeup. A lot of people had psychological trauma with the makeup because their ego was in danger somewhere. Sal had trouble. Michaud continues on in the book to say that Roddy went to the makeup room to watch Sal being made up. After nearly 2 hours of makeup application, Roddy saw near terror in Sal's eyes. He went to the director and told him he was going to have trouble with Sal. Quote, "The makeups were suffocating and Sal panicked," unquote. The result was Sal being released from the picture earlier than originally intended, which resulted in the death of Dr. Milo being written into the beginning half hour of the film.
The character of Dr. Milo meets an untimely end early in the film, much to our disappointment and to Sal Mineo's relief.
We did have to hug Sal a lot. It was very, very difficult for him being confined in the appliances. He was not comfortable at all being a chimpanzee.
Interestingly, according to Kim Hunter, the makeups on the original film were purported to have taken nearly 5 hours to apply from start to finish. However, after now having done two films, the makeup department had since learned to apply the makeups from beginning to end in only 3.5 hours. This was also confirmed by Roddy McDowall when he guest starred on The Carol Burnett Show in 1974 while filming the Planet of the Apes television series. Having appeared in a skit with his ape makeup on, Roddy brought with him footage of the makeup application, which had been recorded by McDowell's friend, Paul Anderson. McDowell shared the footage with the audience of the rigorous ritual he performed every morning while working on the production, and announced in answer to Burnett's questioning that it did indeed take about 3.5 hours to get into the appliances. These appliances were obviously very important to the production, as they not only helped convey the species of the characters the actors portrayed, but as McDowell and Hunter inadvertently discovered while filming, the makeups also helped the actors remain in character.
Dr. Dixon, as a zoologist, I know and respect your work, but if you think you're going to turn a presidential inquiry into a ventriloquist act, I have to inform you.
And I have to inform you, sir, that these two apes have acquired the power of speech.
It was during the filming of this scene that Kim and I had one of our most unusual experiences while working on an apes picture.
Have you a name?
Zira.
One might as well be talking to a parrot.
A parrot? We had to face this presidential commission, and Roddy and I were facing the commission, which was up on a stage, sort of in a semicircle. And we were here, and then behind us were members of press.
Does the other one talk?
Only when she lets me.
So, in order to get rid of all those extras, of course, they shot us first. Then the director said, look, you and Roddy, you can start getting the appliances off, because we're not going to be shooting you the rest of the day. Just to come back, to be off camera, for the presidential commission, for their questions, and respond to the other actors. So it was marvelous. We started taking it off, but it was so weird. Roddy, I said, are you feeling the same thing I'm feeling? Didn't feel like Zira and Cornelius when they started taking this stuff off. I finally said, you know, stop taking it all off. Leave on some. I've got to have it. It just didn't work without the appliances. The character just sort of disappeared. Internally, I was thinking and feeling the same thing, but it didn't come out properly without the appliances. It's very strange.
In fact, this phenomenon is indeed not strange at all. As many modern-day actors have come to understand, doing extensive character work, costumes truly are everything, and very important to a performance. An actor who hasn't yet found the costume for his character may often find it difficult to find the character as well, until the proper wardrobe has been chosen by either the heads of the production or the leading actors themselves. This was the discovery which Kim and Roddy made, to their intense surprise, on the set of Escape. Roddy said of Escape several months after its release, "I like Escape very much. I went to a movie house to see it, and I liked what it did to an audience. I admire Don Taylor very much, and I admire J. Lee Thompson beyond any description." Thompson would later go on to direct Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. Filming for Escape took place primarily in Los Angeles. This was done in an effort to control cost for the production, as well as keep a close eye on the project. This location also gave the film a flair that the other movies lacked. Many of the scenes featured were inspired by situations featured in the original novel by Pierre Boulle, such as the scene where Cornelius attends a boxing match and asking Zira what her bath was like towards the middle of the film. This gave a light-hearted and comedic relief to the story after much drama and hardship had taken place over the first two movies. However, this fun feeling doesn't last for very long. When Zira's pregnancy is discovered, Dr. Hasline forces revelations from Zira about the future of Earth and its eventual domination and destruction by making her drunk. He records her words on a concealed tape recorder, which he later plays back for the president. This results in the apes being quickly taken into custody and held as prisoners. The roles now are reversed in the film. Whereas in the original film, apes were the antagonists, they are now the protagonists, with man as the major threat. Again, as in the first film, the major plot theme is that of the ongoing war against prejudice and fearing that which we don't understand.
Ricardo Montalban.
I identify very much with this man's compassion for these so-called beasts, which were remarkably good and wonderful and kind, because the message to me was man's inhumanity to man, that we have not conquered prejudice. Are we ever going to conquer prejudice? Ever? That's a very powerful theme. What's interesting to me about the Planet of the Apes is that the endings were really not happy. But in a science fiction film, you have a little more margin to be able to express certain things. So the public accepted the unhappy ending because it was truthful. It wasn't just to make you sad. That's the way it is.
The third film was ultimately the love story of Cornelius and Zira, and the love they together shared for their child, which ultimately caused them to sacrifice themselves to save him, when their lives are threatened by Dr. Hasline and his governmental goons.
The ending of the film had caused much debate amongst the production team. The biggest question being, what if the studio asks for another sequel? Producer Jacobs and screenwriter Dane decided not to paint themselves into another corner this time.
Escape from the Planet of the Apes. Their adventures are completely fresh, completely new.
Released in May 1971, Escape from the Planet of the Apes proved to be another box office success. Adult audiences loved the humor and subtle social commentary that the film had brought back to the series, and the elements of fantasy and adventure continued to captivate children. The Apes films were still considered ideal family entertainment. Planet of the Apes was becoming a full-grown franchise, and there seemed to be no end in sight. Planning began for another installment, but this time, the filmmakers would find themselves going down a darker path than they ever had before, one that threatened to lose them their loyal and profitable family audience. The fourth Apes film began shooting on January the 31st, 1972, under the direction of J. Lee Thompson.
Now, you don't look at it, you just take the book.
He was a prolific craftsman whose credits included The Guns of Navarone, the original Cape Fear, and Arthur Jacobs' first production, What a Way to Go. Once again, the script was provided by Paul Dane. The title was Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
Conquest is set 20 years in the future from the time of Cornelius and Zira's deaths in an expansive and cold city, which resembles a police state. A plague has wiped out all dogs and cats on Earth, and in order to fill the void their deaths left behind, humans have taken to adopting apes as pets. But when these pets grow to be the same size as the humans and show signs of near-human intelligence, the apes are soon turned into slaves. In Conquest, Roddy now experienced a new challenge with his role, that of portraying his own son. Certainly, the role of Cornelius has much more substance than many of the regular parts I've had in other movies, McDowell said. I've enjoyed my roles in all of the films, yet I felt that Conquest was the greatest challenge, as it required more depth and characterization than any of the other performances. The makeup wasn't any different from role to role, but Caesar somehow seemed to have different facial characteristics from that of his father, Cornelius. When asked about this phenomenon, McDowell explained, "Different thoughts present a different visage, and that's what acting is all about. Different roles have different sets of thoughts to convey, and they present a different outward appearance, I hope." Cornelius was not a dimensional character in the first film as he was in the third, and he's not as interesting a character as Caesar to play. That doesn't mean that Cornelius is a bad part, it's a very good one. But he was already formed. He has an academic, gentle sense of humor, and he's sort of a peacemaker. He didn't have the complexities of nature that the role in Conquest does, as Caesar goes from being very young mentally to being a kind of despot. Having never seen the world outside of the circus, Caesar is curious to learn what human life outside of the big top looks like. Armando, who has kept his promise to Cornelius and Zira and has become Caesar's guardian, knows the dangers of the outside world and is therefore reluctant to take his ward into it. But he has already sheltered Caesar for far too long. Realizing it is time to teach Caesar about humanity and the dangers it presents, he charters a helicopter to take Caesar out into the city and show him the world. This soon results in a nightmare which unfolds slowly over the period of 2 years and becomes the film's entire story.
Owing to the loyalty of Arthur P. Jacobs, I was given the leading role and had the unique opportunity of playing my own son.
That was the great leap for Roddy, and that was wonderful because it still brought his personality to the character. Maybe he's not the same exact individual, but it's still his spirit coming through. And then he became so identified with the series that the continuity to an audience is Roddy McDowell in Planet of the Apes.
Armando's arrest soon results in Caesar's capture by the overseers of ape management, who subject him to a cruel training process among his fellow apes. He is soon sold at a slave auction and is purchased by the top man in charge of the city's government, Governor Breck. Being in direct contact with the main source of power in the city, Caesar comes to understand what power does for the people who possess it. He also sees, at the hands of his oppressors, what violence and force can bring to those who wield it.
About your sworn statement that the circus ape is incapable of speech.
Armando's death at the hand of the government kills any notion that Caesar has of man's potential for good. He begins to plot a revolution whose purpose is the ultimate destruction of mankind. With a budget of only $1.7 million, the producers had difficulty finding a location where they could film an epic revolution in a city of the future. But, as luck would have it, there was a recently completed commercial and residential complex right next to the studio. Called Century City, it had been built on land that was formerly part of 20th Century Fox's back lot.
It was a pretty new, it had a lot of concrete, stone, and nice angles and nice sharp angles. So it became a kind of a natural thing that if we could shoot there, that we could create a city of the future, but not so far removed from today.
The decision to make the film more action-packed, with a theme of adventure and violence, was a conscious decision on the part of the producers, who were hoping to take the series in a new direction. The first cut of the film was so violent, and the gore quotient so high, the censors rejected it entirely. They felt that with the high level of bloodiness, the film was no longer appropriate to be released as a family picture if the violence remained at its height. Therefore, the producers and director were ordered to cut out a good deal of scenes that contained too much bloodletting. Though some gore still remained in the film, its final cut satisfied the censors and Conquest received a PG rating, keeping it placed in the family film category. However, the political undertone of the film was even darker and much more disturbing than the violence portrayed on the screen, as it was referring to a time not so far or distant in the past where the violence was equally devastating and horrifically unforgettable.
Screenwriter Dane and director Thompson modeled the Apes' revolt after the 1965 Watts riots, an event that had left an indelible impression on the American landscape.
1972, there is no way any major studio was going to release a film with the hero with the leader of the Watts riots. But you could release a film where the leader of an ape slave revolution is your hero. And you can capture the audience's attention and all of a sudden try to get people to maybe rethink the way they were looking at the current events of the time. And that's one of the beauties of really well done science fiction.
We had quite a lot of discussion about the political aspect of the film. Eventually, we showed it in Inglewood, and a largely black audience cheered.
The African-American audience was very vocal. I mean, they'd get up and yell and scream, and you know, all on the side of the apes. You know, it was like, revolution has come.
Where there is fire, there is smoke. In that smoke, from this day forward, my people will crouch and conspire and plot and plan for the inevitable day of man's downfall. And we shall build our own cities in which there will be no place for humans except to serve our ends. And we shall found our own armies, our own religion, our own dynasty. And that day is upon you now!
As originally shot, Caesar's final victory speech was a militant call for revolution.
No.
But responding to test audience reaction, the studio and producer Arthur Jacobs decided to alter this speech in post-production. I was called in to record some additional lines, ending the film on a more hopeful note.
But now we will put away our hatred. Now we will put down our weapons. And we, who are not human, can afford to be humane. If it is man's destiny to be dominated, it is God's will that he be dominated with compassion. So, cast out your vengeance. Tonight, we have seen the birth of the planet of the apes.
War, urban violence, racial unrest. Issues that were strongly influencing popular movie entertainment in 1972. Films like Dirty Harry, The French Connection, Shaft, and yes, even Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
All of the Apes films were recorded to have been smashes at the box office on their opening nights, and Conquest was no exception. It was the number one top-grossing film in its first week after its release, and made the studio a whopping $4,395,549 in July of 1972. Escape from the Planet of the Apes did very well too, bringing the studio $12,300,000 in May of 1971. The parallels in this film to Roddy McDowall's career and personal life are an interesting and fun note to add. Roddy's character in Conquest is called Caesar. Technically, this was the second time Roddy would play a character called Caesar, as his character of Octavian from Cleopatra would soon become Augustus Caesar after the death of the first dictator of the same name. Also interesting to note, Conquest was the only Apes film to be shot in Todd A.O., which was developed by Elizabeth Taylor's deceased husband, Mike Todd. Elizabeth Taylor was Roddy McDowall's best friend from childhood, and his co-star in Lassie Come Home, where they met in 1943, The White Cliffs of Dover in 1944, Cleopatra in 1963, and finally, the two would work together for one last time on the small screen, sharing a guest spot on the soap opera Hotel in the first episode of the second season called Intimate Strangers. McDowall forever had a soft spot for all the roles he played in the Planet of the Apes saga. When asked why by Leslie Wilkinson in his article From Child Star to Movie Director in October of 1971, McDowall answered, "Because I love makeup. Also, it's a challenge to have to act through the chimp makeup in order to make the character come across to the audience." Challenge for McDowall was not annoyance, but treasure, which he relished digging up and experiencing to the highest level. This enjoyment of characteristic challenges brought sparkle to every single performance given by McDowall, and his dedication to each character is evident in every film he appears in. The stories of both Escape From and Conquest of the Planet of the Apes both held very important political storylines, and had arrested the attention of all who came to view them. The Planet of the Apes saga had created a voice, which resonated with its audiences of all ages. There was only one question which remained. Now that the story had been rebooted, how would it finally end? The studio knew that an end to the saga was at this point inevitable, but wondered if their decision to make the most violent picture in Apes history was now hampering their ability to create a finale that was family-friendly. The next production would soon answer that question for all who were interested.
Soon after Conquest's release in 1972, producer Arthur Jacobs once again asked Paul Dane to develop and script the fifth Apes feature. Dane quickly submitted a treatment entitled Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
The production began filming on January 2, 1973, with a budget of $1.8 million. Battle was meant to be geared directly towards children. After the increased violence of Conquest, the producers were hoping to keep the attraction to the family audience in the foreground of the story. Paul Dane had originally hoped that the cast for Battle would be made up of all the main cast members from Conquest. Roddy McDowall and Natalie Trundy both returned, reprising their roles as Caesar and Lisa.
For me, it was back to the makeup chair for another chance to play Caesar. I was anxious to do it because I'd enjoyed the role even more than I had the part of Cornelius.
They also brought in Bobby Porter, who would play Caesar's son, Cornelius. Porter would later go on to play a bit part in a short-lived science fiction TV series, which Roddy would soon co-star in, called The Fantastic Journey, in 1977. Porter, standing at 4 feet 10 inches tall, was 21 at the time he portrayed Cornelius, who was supposed to be much younger, perhaps 11 or 12 years old. Don Murray, who played Governor Breck, and Harry Rhodes, who played Mr. McDonald, were also approached to return, but both refused. The character of McDonald was important to the storyline, however, so the scriptwriters creatively changed it from being the McDonald from Conquest and made the character McDonald's brother. Austin Stoker was then cast in the role. With the absence of a villain now causing a difficulty since Don Murray was not interested in returning, the writers asked Severn Darden, who portrayed Inspector Culp, if he was interested. He was, and agreed to reprise his role from the previous film. He was therefore written into the script as the integral villain for the main storyline.
The story focused on the ape leader, Caesar, just a few years after he has led the ape revolution. An off-screen nuclear war has occurred, and Caesar now rules over a surviving band of apes and humans. The two species have forged a fragile coexistence. The apes are also working with the humans to educate themselves and have begun forming their own laws. In keeping with Jacob's new concept, Caesar's character was softened.
Cornelius.
He is no longer militant and angry.
Cornelius.
But patient and benevolent. Natalie Trundy again signed on to play my wife, Lisa. This was the fourth Apes film for both of us. Some carefully placed rubble and a clever matte painting created the illusion of a bombed-out Forbidden City, where a group of radiation-scarred humans continue to live. For the interior of the Forbidden City, the producers used the Hyperion Water Treatment Plant located in Los Angeles. Another interesting casting note, the orangutan Virgil, was played by singer-songwriter Paul Williams. When the humans from the Forbidden City launch an attack, Caesar is caught in a political power struggle with the commander of the military, General Aldo, played by the noted character actor Claude Akins. Like all the entries in the series, Battle for the Planet of the Apes contained plenty of rousing action sequences.
Now, fight like apes!
Near the film's conclusion, the mutant humans are defeated. But the action is tempered by a much more pacifistic tone than in previous Apes films. Caesar also discovers that Aldo is responsible for the death of his son. And one final battle for the Planet of the Apes is fought.
Ape City, where Caesar's new civilization of apes lived, was filmed, like the first Apes installment, at Malibu Creek State Park. Battle for the Planet of the Apes, like its predecessors, did well at the box office, grossing $4,864,355 during the weeks of June 17th and June 24th, 1973. The wardrobe from this film were the outfits from the three prequels, separating the ape classes by color. The chimpanzees being dressed in forest green with chocolate brown leather collars, the orangutans in orange molded leather, and the gorillas in burgundy coats with black leather trim. The apes have also now gained the abilities to read, write, and speak fluent English. This is not explained in the film, but it is generally assumed the costumes were reused due to the tiny budget the production was given by the studio. Battle for the Planet of the Apes premiered in May of 1973. The film now released, and yet another smash hit at the box office, producer Arthur P. Jacobs died of a heart attack at the age of 51 years old, just days after the film's premiere. Roddy McDowall said in an interview in 1981 about the movies, "Apes are wonderful characters and an enormous acting challenge. Our apes are perfectly adorable and terribly sweet people, but a little bizarre." Some ape characters, indeed, were bizarre, and bizarre characters would continue to be invented even still when the television series was launched in September of 1974. Once again, Roddy was cast in the leading role, this time playing Galen, an assistant to Dr. Zaius, who becomes a fugitive while helping two astronauts in their journey to return home. The show was mildly successful, but lacked the steam and creative talent it needed to keep the storyline fresh and consistent, and it was canceled after 14 episodes. Roddy's makeup application to transform into Galen took even less time than it did to transform into Cornelius and Caesar. Where in the beginning it took 5 hours, then later 4, it now only took 3. Once the makeups were applied, it limited the actor's ability to eat, drink, and favorite above all for McDowell, smoke. Roddy was a chain smoker and was forced to use an extra long cigarette holder in order to enjoy his unhealthy vice. While asked by Smash Magazine about the makeup in 1974, Roddy admitted that it wasn't entirely pleasant. "Well, you get very hot, and not only that, but as the day wears on, you don't get enough oxygen to your skin. It's somewhat disturbing. I have a marvelous makeup man, Freddy Blau, who puts a lot of stuff on my face to protect it. And then we made a deal when I came to do this series that the makeup can be on my face only a certain number of hours a day." Having had experience with the films beforehand, I know where the exhaustion point is. When the makeups have been on about 10 hours, you start to get really bugged. Even so, I enjoy the reality of the appliance. It's really very effective. The effectiveness to which Roddy referred was in regards to how the costumes bring the ape characters to life for the actors portraying them, as mentioned in the previous show by Kim Hunter from their experience on Escape from the Planet of the Apes. Without the appliances, part of the characters were lost, and the actors were unable to regain their original performances without the costumes. According to Leslie Salisbury, who interviewed Roddy in the 1977 article entitled The Million Dollar Face, Roddy's experiences on the set were rather arduous. Salisbury says, "The films were hard work. He spent 11 hours a day glued into the rubber mask makeup and hairy costume, working on locations that sent his body heat soaring. After 5 days of almost continuous wear, the mask would cause his skin to break out in a rash. His face was insured for $1 million. No one knew what lasting damage could be done to the skin," McDowell commented. "Once, I stayed in the mask for 19 hours and nearly collapsed with the heat and exhaustion. I had a cyst on my head caused by the dirt from the wig." This was not the first time Roddy had suffered from cysts, however. He also suffered from them during battle. As well as suffering from a terrible cold during battle, Roddy developed 3 small cysts on his face from continual application and removal of the ape makeups. The cysts were painful for him, and he had to have the cysts surgically removed. "I tended to forget the discomfort," Roddy said. 8 months or more would pass between these films, and I didn't quite remember how wearing they really were. I had to report for work at 5 o'clock in the morning to spend a little under 4 hours in the makeup chair being transformed into a chimpanzee. But that's not the main thing that bothered me. I'm not a true claustrophobe, but after a time, not being able to scratch my nose, eat anything, or drink except through a straw really works on my nerves. After 5 hours, I really became a basket case. Despite being uncomfortable in the makeups and occasionally being mocked by onlookers not associated with the productions, Roddy treasured his time being a chimpanzee for the films. "The parts are good, and there's the challenge of communicating through the appliances. They're not literally masks. I think that's why we have had so many fine actors in the pictures. They like the challenge. Masks are in the oldest tradition of the theater, and there is something exciting about reviving an ancient art." Ancient art transcended to modern-day artistic spectacle is partially what brought the films in the Apes franchise the magic they possess, even today, 50 years after the first film's release in 1968.
"As I look at apes and humans, living in friendship, harmony, and at peace, now some 600 years after Caesar's death, at least we wait with hope for the future.
Nah, Gibber, who knows about the future?
Perhaps only the dead."
Although Jacobs ultimately wanted to send a positive social message, the film's final image is rather ambiguous. Is the statue of Caesar crying a tear of joy because man and ape are finally at peace?
"We have a destiny too,
respecting each other as equals."
Or is it a tear of sorrow because he knows that is an impossibility?
"The human way is violence and death."
These questions would never be resolved because during the early stages of production, it had been decided that this would be the final chapter in the Ape series. And that is how it was advertised when it reached theaters in May of 1973.
We felt like we had come pretty far. Again, production value-wise, we'd gotten to a point where we'd practically boxed ourselves in. If we went any further into the future and told a continuing story, it would have been a much more expensive picture.
But the story wasn't over yet. Battle had done surprisingly well at the box office, and the CBS network had recently garnered tremendous ratings with the broadcast premieres of the first 3 films. Although Jacobs and Fox briefly considered producing another Apes movie, it was agreed that the future of the franchise might best be explored in the uncharted universe of television. Jacobs had considered a Planet of the Apes television series as early as 1971, but the continued success of the theatrical features delayed his plans for 2 years. He had also been busy on a number of non-ape films that included Woody Allen's Play It Again, Sam, and family musicals like Goodbye, Mr. Chips and Tom Sawyer. But during the production of his latest film, a musical adaptation of Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, Arthur Jacobs died of a heart attack. He was only 51 years old.
"Arthur was very, very tough, but everybody loved him. But he was always there. He was always on the set. I tell you, the man worked 29 hours, 8 days a week. He was with everything all the time. It was just wonderful. He was an extraordinary man."
"Arthur's
strongest point was his intense sense of the meticulous. But it generated results. He was one of a kind. And I do miss him.
With Jacob's death, development of the Apes television series was in the hands of 20th Century Fox. With the help of writers Anthony Wilson and Art Wallace, they began to hammer out a workable concept. And on September the 13th, 1974, Planet of the Apes premiered on CBS. I starred, along with Ron Harper and James Norton. They played astronauts Alan Verdon and Peter Burke, who are propelled through a time warp and land on Earth in the year 3085. By the way, their vehicle was the same plywood spaceship used in the original film.
Yeah, well, we could have landed in a worse place, I'll tell you that.
It isn't long before they're captured and find themselves face to face with a favorite Apes feature film character, Dr. Zaius, now played by stage actor Booth Coleman. With the help of a sympathetic ape named Galen, the astronauts escape.
Watch out!
Well, we kind of became the fugitive, you know. Each week we were caught and then we escaped. That's basically what each show is about. And I think that television frequently winds up in a kind of a formulaic role. Who's the bad guy of the week and how are you going to escape from that?
Week after week, the trio was relentlessly pursued by the ape military commander, General Urko. Urko was played by Mark Leonard, best known for his portrayal of Mr. Spock's father in another famous science fiction series, Star Trek. The show tried to retain many elements that had made the motion picture so successful. There was drama. A little bit of humor.
There's a smell about you. Nobody's perfect.
Some social commentary.
These humans, they think they're as good as we are.
And plenty of action.
We're constantly whacking some guy over the head with a stick or drop kicking a guy in a monkey suit. We had apes falling out of the trees all over the place.
The television series' most loyal and faithful audience were children. But network executives claimed children were not the audience advertisers wanted to attract. The show was also scheduled up against two of the highest-rated comedies of the day, Sanford and Son and Chico and the Man. It wasn't long before the inevitable happened. On December the 6th, 1974, after only 4 months and 13 episodes, Planet of the Apes was cancelled. And for the first time in its history, the future of apes was uncertain.
The show's cancellation sparked outrage among its fans, which resulted in the network being bombarded with so many angry letters demanding it be saved that the newspapers were forced to write about it. One such article from the National Star, published January 11, 1975, was entitled Angry TV Fans Clamor for Return of Planet Ape, and read as follows. Thousands of angry TV fans are demanding the return of Planet of the Apes, axed by CBS in the ratings war. The sudden cancellation of the show left many fans stunned. The network explained its drastic action by stating, "The ratings on the show were poor." But there was more to it than that. Planet of the Apes failed for two key reasons. Despite its slick production and strong cast, it couldn't handle the powerhouse NBC combination of Sanford and Son and Chico and the Man, and it was aimed at too young an audience. Many adults just couldn't get hooked into the series. There was no chance for a rescue operation either. CBS decided to axe Planet of the Apes before anything could be done to revamp the series to appeal to an older audience. And the network's top brass were so disappointed by the show's poor ratings, they refused to consider giving it another chance in a new time slot. Meanwhile, letters demanding the return of the series keep pouring in. Here's a sample of some of the hundreds of letters the Star has received. The best show on TV throughout the fall was Planet of the Apes. Roddy McDowell is simply fantastic. I could hardly wait all week for the show to be on. Come on, NBC or ABC, be smart and grab the series from CBS. Don't let a show like that die. Mrs. Chris Cooper, Brooklyn, New York. Several more letters followed the remaining pages of this article, which read similarly to the first, demanding that the show be brought back and the Nielsen ratings be hanged. But all to no avail. The series remained canceled in America. Meanwhile, during the months after its cancellation in the U.S., Apes began running in syndication in the U.K. and became a sensation. Had the series run in the U.K. and not in the U.S., it is highly possible the series would have lasted much longer than its ill-fated 14 episodes. But the series does live on. After its success in the U.K. in 1975, the series went on to become a cult classic, and due to its British resurgence, was transferred to DVD and is readily and easily available for fans to have access to this day.
In the beginning, there was Planet of the Apes, and the most exciting series in motion picture history began.
Although the demise of the television series had proved disappointing to fans, its premiere had been accompanied by a media blitz that included the re-release of all five films to theaters in 1974.
Now is your chance to go ape.
Roddy said later that he was very sad the series had been canceled, and he wished very much that there had been more Apes projects with which he could have been a part of. But he also admitted that playing the various roles in the films and on the television series was no easy, and often physically no pleasant, task to perform. In part of a 1970s newspaper article on the TV series, subtitled "Turning Roddy into Chimp Leaves Him Tired and Hungry," Roddy was quoted to have said, "It's a tough part to play, from a physical standpoint, I mean. When I made the first picture, they gave me an allergy test to see if I would suffer any ill effects from the makeup. I did. I got a cyst under the wig I had to wear. The studio, 20th Century Fox, figured there was some risk, so they insured my face. I don't know what this series will cost, but I know I never heard of any show having more than two makeup men. We'll be lucky to get away with just six." Two main makeup men were assigned to McDowell during the run of the series. One, who had worked on the first Apes movie and was one of many apprentices under John Chambers. His name was Dan Strepek. The other was Freddie Blau, who did most of the heavy lifting in regards to making sure Roddy's expensive face was protected during the makeup process every day. Roddy's day in the makeup chair was arduous. "I have to come in at 4 a.m. every day," he said. "It takes 3 hours to get all this goo on and transform my face to the chimpanzee I play. I can't eat lunch. If I do, the saliva will start to flow and this will start the mask to crack. Maybe I can have some juice, I don't know. I can't talk much. The more I talk, the more strain on this mask. I can tell you one thing, luncheon interviews are out. The less you talk and eat, the longer the mask stays on. I have to go through this makeup session every morning. In the afternoon, the makeup men have to take it off. The only thing they can save is the ears. Everything else has to be thrown away." The makeup process, as Roddy mentioned, would take a total of 3.5 hours, and would be cut in half for a short amount of time, so that Roddy could rest, eat breakfast, and be in the solitude and privacy of his air-conditioned trailer before his hair pieces were applied prior to shooting. The makeup department on the TV series was a major center of activity, where actors, makeup artists, and hairdressers were consistently running in and out at all hours prior to filming time. Freddie Blau would perform the first half of Roddy's makeup application, being careful to apply protective wax, called Dumold, to the actor's eyebrows and sideburns, before smearing the glue for the ape appliances to those same areas. This protected the delicate hairs from being ripped out at the end of the day, when Roddy, who had a habit of ripping the appliances off his face in one hand when the day's shooting had wrapped, did his thing and removed the makeups with understandable gusto. The ape appliances were made out of foam latex, which is a very firm and yet flexible substance when hardened. John Chambers found that the substance not only was durable for filming situations, but that it also allowed the actors to have maximum range of movement, giving them the ability to freely express emotions through the makeups, without having too much discomfort as they did so. This was good enough for troopers like Roddy, Kim Hunter, and Natalie Trundy, but it was not good enough for the original choices for the characters of Cornelius, Zira, and Dr. Zaius, who were originally to have been played by Edward G. Robinson, Julie Harris, and Rock Hudson. All tried out for the roles with the ape makeup, and all bowed out before production began because they found the appliances too confining and uncomfortable. When the makeup application was completed and Roddy's hair pieces had been added as the final touch, the group of artists followed the actor out of the Winnebago trailer in which they had been couched for most of the morning, to reveal the handsome ape Galen in blue jeans and a blue terry cloth robe, ready to change into his costume for filming. Once the ape makeup had finished being applied in full, none of the actors could eat solid food for the remainder of the day. They would be given only liquids for their meals during lunchtime. This liquid diet, combined with the heat of the day and the additional heat of the ape costumes, caused the actors to lose a lot of weight, sometimes as much as 10 pounds a day. Others found that using a foot-long cigarette holder to enjoy their favorite vice of smoking was too much of a chore, and this alone allowed the actors to stop smoking during the months they worked on the production. Roddy was not one of the actors who quit, and used the extra-long cigarette holder daily, with no complaints. Despite painful days and long bouts of discomfort where he was hungry from being unable to eat, feeling cramped after hours of confinement in the appliances, and unable to do simple things like scratch his nose that he would begin to cry from the discomfort, Roddy said from the beginning to the end of the saga that he genuinely loved playing an ape and wanted to play one for much longer than he had had the chance to. In the 1990s, Roddy was interviewed by the Sci-Fi Channel, who was running the Apes films and the TV series during Apes Week. They recorded several hours' worth of footage where Roddy introduced all five films and spoke at the commercial breaks, and then later showed him sitting down, talking about the television series when all 14 episodes were aired. The following clips you are about to hear are Roddy's bumpers from the week where the TV series was being shown on the Sci-Fi Channel. The audio is about 6 minutes and 17 seconds long, has been put in logical order, and has been edited down to reduce or altogether cut out some jarring sound effects and science fiction horror background noise, which was inserted by the studio for the finished bumpers. This has been done not only for time purposes, but also to cut down on the amount of startling sounds, which might be triggers for any listeners who suffer from anxiety or have difficulty with sharp or loud noises.
I was very sad, actually, that the Planet of the Apes TV series did not go on. People used to say to me, oh, you must have been so relieved when it was over because of all the makeup and everything else. But I wasn't at all. I really felt that that series not only had something to say, but was highly entertaining, but it was wonderful to be associated with. The series is different, number one, because the central character, Galen, is an entirely different individual, and on a series of different adventures. The first character I played was Cornelius, who was sort of very studious and intellectual. And then Cornelius and Zira, Kim Hunter, we were killed in the third film. And then I played my own son, who was Caesar, which is a character I liked a great deal because that was sort of... I mounted that really on the idea of a combination of Zira and Cornelius, but it was more fun because Zira had much more of a sense of humor. She was much more larky than Cornelius, so he was more fun to play in a sense than Cornelius. And then when the television series came along, that character I adored playing because he, Galen, was so full of fun and had a tremendous enjoyment of things. It was very inventive and great fun to do. I like Galen the best. As an actor, sometimes you get to play roles that really make you want to be a better person, or perhaps cause you, in a sense, to be a better person. Certainly those characters in Apes or in that arena. All the attributes of Galen were certainly ones that, as a human being, I would be happy to embrace and only wish I could be. So it was a wonderful skin to be inside. Galen actually was sort of an everyman or every chimp, you know. He was a chimp of extremely good character and full of value, good motives. As an actor, the opportunity to play a chimpanzee doesn't come along very often, and it was a wildly complicated and very rewarding acting assignment, because one couldn't use
really quite the normal technique in order to play those roles, because you had to convey what you were thinking and feeling through an immense amount of appliance, makeup appliance. So the thought processes had to be most particular. I find it intriguing. And the makeup teams that were involved were so extraordinary. Those men were not only imaginative, but so deeply kind. So I also love the fact that children really appreciated and loved all of those projects. There were a lot of them. I wish there'd been more. All of the acting choices were just human, because one of the points of these chimpanzees were that they had evolved to another level. All one did was play the intent and content of a human being. When you've got that much slap all over you, you really don't have to try and pretend to be a chimpanzee or an orangutan. It's done for you. When one was first thinking about how these characters would physically be, when he got into the costume, it just didn't seem right to be standing straight up. It just seemed wrong. And suddenly, where the physicalization actually came from, ultimately, was in just walking back and forth and thinking, I suddenly thought of Groucho Marx. You know, he'd walk around with bent legs, and it just, when you bent your knees, it just seemed, it felt right. And also fusing from, mentally fusing your body from your shoulders to the end of your rump, just keeping it so that you're moving in one piece. That seemed correct. So the spine seemed to... No. That just felt right and felt like an original, you know, some place to be that was somewhere between a human being and a chimpanzee. As an actor, it was a great gymnasium, because inside the character, one got to play other characters. I remember one time having to be disguised as a lady chimp on some escape. I think one of the most attractive aspects of the Planet of the Apes canon was the optimism involved and the decency of the message. The stories are so terrific. They're very important pieces. I think they say something that is quite potent and valuable. It's about 20 years since the last of the series was made. They're just as relevant and potent now. They always will be. Prejudice, abuse, lack of compassion, all of those things are involved in that material. How we as human beings are prone to these terrible reactions. All of this area of work is can be very dangerous, because the moment you're dealing with makeups and costumes that are blinding, you know, put blinders on your vision, or costumes that are complex and make your movements, then it's very easy to have accidents. In one of the apes, the horse I was riding, a nest of bees bit the horse up the rump, and it flew up in the air, that horse. I got my feet out of the stirrups, but not in time to fly off the horse, and the horse, I was on the ground with the horse on top of me. Luckily, it was in sand. That is the last time I decided from then on it was only going to be doubles did the work, because it was too dangerous. You get wiser as you get older.
Planet of the Apes was definitely capable of making history with its successes at the box office, but the franchise was about to create something else, which would later set a trend that to us in modern day is as common as bubblegum and baseball cards, but back then was unheard of and considered to be superfluous. Movie merchandising.
20th Century Fox, long aware of apes' popularity with children, also launched an extensive marketing and merchandising campaign, encouraging kids all over the country to go ape. It was phenomenally successful.
There were 60 companies that were licensed to turn out something like 300 items. Just this flood of apes' products on the market.
There were ape action figures, masks, posters, games, lunchboxes, and coloring books. There was even a Planet of the Apes waste paper basket.
And I think Apes probably helped pave the way for the later films like Star Wars and all, where you have these mass merchandising blitzes, which are now so common that we don't think of them as being anything extraordinary.
Return to the planet of the apes!
In 1975, NBC TV launched Return to the Planet of the Apes, a half-hour Saturday morning cartoon series that depicted a more evolved simian culture.
We got all of them, Urkel.
Good. Take them to Ape City.
As in the original novel, apes were finally allowed to drive cars and fly airplanes. Though the animated series lasted only 1 year, other ape incarnations proved to have greater longevity. More than three decades after the premiere of the first film, apes' references still managed to find their way into American pop culture. From films and television to merchandising and memorabilia, Planet of the Apes and its numerous sequels have conquered audiences all over the world. And people continue to be captivated for many different reasons.
I think it just struck people's imagination. It was different, and it still is.
You led me around on a leash. We thought you were inferior.
Now you know better.
They're just as valid now as when they first came out, and probably will be 30 years from now.
Some of the social statements unfortunately remain with us. Planet of the Apes brings them back to our attention.
What's the difference? You're all monkeys.
Please do not use the word monkey.
Possibility we could do something horrible lurks in our consciousness. To me, that is the element which has stirred so much interest.
What is Doomsday?
Planet of the Apes depended on characterization as well as adventure. If you've got good characters, they'll stand the test of time.
Apes is a trailblazer with this kind of material. It probably helped to push into the things that have happened since.
Well, I think the makeup, of course, is the most innovative, because for the first time, really, these were actors working and emotions coming through this makeup.
I was the guy that helped make those pictures work, and it's a wonderful feeling to go that long and that those pictures stand up as well as they have.
I believe that they have a life of their own. I don't think you can kill totally the Planet of the Apes. I think there'll always be an audience.
I still get fan mail from all over the world.
I think it's going to carry on.
It appeals to everybody, little kids, grown-ups, anybody. Because it widens the avenue of the imagination.
Ape and man, ancestors and brothers, their fates hopelessly intertwined. One holds the secret of the past, the other, the key to the future. But which is which? Planet of the Apes holds up a mirror and asks us simply to look at ourselves, at our fears and prejudices, at our hopes and dreams. But as a new millennium dawns, can we expect more exciting adventures on the Planet of the Apes? Perhaps the answer lies somewhere in the stars. Or maybe, right here, on Earth.
The Planet of the Apes saga has officially come to an end. The films and TV series are now a part of history. But its effect on fans today is still the same, as these podcast episodes can attest. That is all for this episode of Not Just Yesterday, the Roddy McDowall Podcast. Thank you for listening. And as always, dear friends, this is Zoe Dean reminding you to keep smiling.
You seem to bring faraway spring near. I'm always in full bloom when you're in the room, for every night at 7,
you make it happen.
Every time the same thing happens, I fall once again in love, but only with you.
Every night about 7.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Not Just Yesterday, the Roddy McDowall Podcast. If you enjoy the show, a great way to help support us is to leave a rating and review on iTunes. This gives us better ideas of how we can constantly improve the program for your enjoyment. You can also support the show by becoming a patron. To become a patron of Not Just Yesterday, please visit www.patreon.com/RoddyMcDowellPod. The podcast is hosted, written, edited, and produced by Zoe Dean. The occasional co-writer, research assistant, and constant help for this podcast is Julie Carricker. The thoughts expressed on this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of Barren Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The musical tracks, films, and television shows discussed and heard in these podcasts remain the property of their respective owners. The audio clips used in this episode are from Behind the Planet of the Apes, the 20th Century Fox documentary on the Apes saga, and falls under the 20th Century Fox copyright. The music tracks heard throughout this episode are from the official soundtrack for Planet of the Apes, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, and Battle for the Planet of the Apes, and were composed by Jerry Goldsmith and Leonard Rosenman. Not Just Yesterday does not own the rights to these tracks used, nor does it claim ownership. Not Just Yesterday, the Roddy McDowell podcast, is not affiliated with any major film or television company, and no copyright infringement is intended. Please visit barrenspace.com for this and other amazing content. This has been a Barren Space production.